Welcome to Your Child's Brain, a podcast series produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR. I'm Dr. Brad Schlager, President and CEO of Kennedy Krieger Institute. And today, for this seventh episode of Your Child's Brain, we will be discussing the most common disorder of neurodevelopment, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. I'm joined by my colleagues, Dr. Kerry Rush, psychologist in Kennedy Krieger's Center for Neurodevelopmental and Imaging Research, and Dr. Stuart Mostofsky, pediatric neurologist and the director of the Center for Neurodevelopmental and Imaging Research. Welcome, Kerry and Stuart. So Stuart, let's start out with sort of setting the table. What is ADHD? How common is it? And how do you diagnose it?
Thank you, Brad. ADHD is, as you mentioned, the most common psychiatric disorder of childhood affecting approximately 8 to 10% of school-aged children. It is characterized by age-inappropriate levels of impulsive, hyperactive, and distractible inattentive behavior that has a detrimental impact on functioning across multiple settings, such as school, home, and social environments. If not addressed, it can be associated with significant functional impairment into adolescence and adulthood, including impaired social relations, difficulties at school and work, struggles with substance use, and a range of mental health difficulties. So if there is suspicion about ADHD, it is important that it be diagnosed using a comprehensive evaluation, then addressed using a range of options. You asked how it's diagnosed, and there are three key aspects to diagnosing ADHD. First, confirming the presence of ADHD symptoms and that these symptoms are occurring across multiple settings. So this typically involves clinical interviews with...
What is that? Can you unpack that?
Well, you know, the whole spectrum of eating disorders in children is pretty broad. And we've tried to come up with definitions that separate children with a significant problem from those who are picky eaters. And the term ARFID, you know, really tries to sock it to the issue and that we're trying to describe children who are really avoiding food and it's restrictive and it's significant. This is very different than the child who won't eat broccoli or, you know, the typical toddler who only eat a few things at a meal. So it's a complex term because it's a complex problem. There's a newer term that's being used, and it's now being more widely disseminated, just pediatric feeding disorder, which broadens the category, but doesn't really describe the problems as we as professionals see it. So, as I'm fond of saying, everybody's an expert in feeding, including grandparents, but truly there are only a few people who are really experts in managing these complex problems, and ARFID requires a very unique set of treatments.
Richard, sticking with you, we heard a bit about onset of feeding problems in infancy. So what are some of the causes of these very early feeding problems?
You know, as in many things in medicine, we can only speculate about things that happen in babies. They clearly can't tell us what's going on, but we take care of a lot of premature infants who have been intubated for a long time when they're awake. And I try to describe to parents, like, you know, imagine what a spoon would look like if that's coming at you versus a tube coming at you when you're awake. So yeah, there's a natural tendency to avoid that kind of abnormal or painful stimulus. But there are other things as well. And, you know, we really don't always know, but a lot of children have gastroesophageal reflux, bringing stomach contents back up into the esophagus or vomiting and bringing up acid, and that can injure the esophagus, cause discomfort, and then, you know, what do you do if you have something uncomfortable? You try to avoid that. So we think that that may be one reason why children have food restriction when they've been refluxing. But there's also a whole host of anatomic and developmental issues that these children have too. Lots of children who have complex medical problems unrelated to having surgery in the GI tract and things like that tend to avoid noxious stimuli, which they think food is, when they've been sick for a long time.
Peter, picking up on that, these behaviors that seem to be in response to a threat or sense of imminent discomfort, can you talk more about what are some of the other reasons that a child might develop a feeding problem?
Yeah, so as Richard touched upon, children at a young age can be exposed to painful or discomfort feeding experiences, which could lead to some form of conditioned aversion. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of every time you tried to eat, you threw up or it was uncomfortable, you probably would want to avoid that. leading to a lot of other issues. As children avoid food, they are often missing through very crucial developmental stages. We take for granted that a child at 6 months or a year is being exposed to different types and tastes and textures. Imagine not having that occur until you're 3 or 4 years of age. You're missing that experience, not just being exposed to these flavors and these new things, these colors, and you're also not using your oral motor skills, making it more difficult for you to actually consume these foods. And then you also have that interaction with the parents. You have parents who might be very nervous or cautious because their children had a medical issue. Kids who are throwing up or pushing food away, parents are often quick to say, okay, that's right here. Let me provide you with your preferred food. Starting this process of, is it medical? Is it developmental? Is it behavioral? That kind of takes its own genesis and moves into more significant issues.
I think just continuing with you, Peter, that there's this concept of picky eater versus feeding disorder. How do you draw the line, and what distinguishes between just a picky eater and somebody who's going on to have a feeding disorder?
We don't expect everybody to like everything. We don't like all foods. We have preferences, and actually it's kind of normal to be not want a particular food. Not wanting all the green vegetables at a young age is not something that you'll be too worried about, providing that you have a number of foods in other categories. There's a term called neophobia, where it's normal to be nervous about trying new things. It's kind of evolutionary. But then you start going into more moderate selectivity, where you start to see a very...
When do parents and clinicians need to recognize that it's time to begin treatment? And I guess along those same lines, are there differences in treatments for boys and girls?
Yeah, sure. Great question. So evidence-based treatments for ADHD include behavioral therapy and generally stimulant medication as a first line, although there are non-stimulant medications that are also approved and recommended for ADHD. And there's research over decades now showing that these combined treatments, meaning behavioral therapy and medication, can be the most effective. And often when done in combination, you can have a lower dose of medication if paired with behavior therapy and get greater improvement. Because I know many parents will have concerns about using medication. So that's sort of a nice compromise if you do both together. We also know that behavioral treatments are more likely to result in long-term effects because you're teaching skills and strategies, whereas medication only works as long as you're taking it. And once you stop the medication, those symptoms will resume. So behavior treatment, what does that mean? What is behavioral therapy? For ADHD, especially in childhood, it starts with behavioral parent training and teaching parents really how to manage their child's symptoms and also informing teachers about how to sort of manage symptoms of ADHD in the classroom. Because these symptoms are present across settings, we really need to support kids in both settings. Sometimes for parent training, this is best done in a group format where parents can hear from other parents of children with ADHD about their struggles at home and what's working and not for their children. So we can learn a lot from other parents in our treatments. And often there's a therapist that will guide that discussion. Also, sometimes we'll do kids' social skills groups. So that's the therapy that will involve the child or emotion regulation groups. We know that emotion regulation difficulties are common in 30 to 50% of children with ADHD. So teaching kids how to identify their emotions, how to regulate them, how to deal with those angry and sad feelings in a way that's more adaptive. And also in adolescence and adulthood, we're involving the child or patient themselves in therapy more so than the parents, where we're teaching them skills for managing their own symptoms at school and with peers. In adulthood, that would include strategies like cognitive behavioral therapy too. In children, sometimes we'll see that cognitive behavioral therapy is needed if they often have symptoms of anxiety or depression that go along with their ADHD. But again, the first line behavioral therapy is really teaching parents kind of how to be their child's therapist at home, because these symptoms have to be managed constantly throughout the day, not just in a 1 hour therapy session each week. And right now we don't treat girls and boys with ADHD differently. We treat the symptoms that they're presenting with, but there's not sort of designated treatments for girls versus boys. But as we do more research on understanding these sex versus gender kind of effects, it might inform these treatments.
Stuart, let's pick up on the topic of therapies and interventions. What do you see as around the corner on the new vistas for treatment for ADHD?
Yeah, there were a number of new treatment approaches and some medication, but some really what seemed to be some promising behavioral approaches that really have the opportunity to bring long-lasting, potentially even lifelong improvements for individuals with ADHD. One such approach that we've been investigating is the use of mindfulness movement interventions such as yoga, still meditation, and Tai Chi. In fact, last year, we published findings from our laboratory demonstrating that children showed significant improvements in ADHD and other behaviors after an 8-week Tai Chi intervention. Interestingly, we also found that these children showed improvements in motor function, and the degree of motor improvements predicted the degree to which parents reported improvements in ADHD behavior. So the findings suggest that mindful movement practice holds promise for helping children, perhaps not only those with ADHD, but even all children, to build skills needed to focus and better regulate their behavior. This is similar in a way to how practice and exercise can help build motor skills. So you're building these skills of focusing, staying on task, and regulating your behavior. And what's exciting is that in contrast to how medications...
What do I do the rest of the day? She says, well, who doesn't eat? And it was a very good example of that, you know, in terms of the view of people in, you know, other situations where they don't understand that this is a significant issue.
Well, we've talked about the composition of this multidisciplinary team and its importance for diagnosis, understanding exactly what we're dealing with each individual child. The next question is, how are feeding disorders treated? What is the approach? Peter, maybe we could start with you.
So like Richard touched upon, the most important part is finding out the why. The kids have multiple various factors of why they're not eating. If there's a medical issue, that medical issue needs to be treated, because if you're not treating that issue, you're trying to get someone to eat or try to work on oral motor skills, and they might be in discomfort. The other part is that also, can they eat? What's their ability? You know, our goal is really to reach the children's potential. And again, we work with these folks to try to get them as far along the process as they can, because as we just discussed, how important eating is socially and culturally. Just being able to sit at the table, that's where a lot of families have their opportunities to get to share their days with each other. So we take that approach as an interdisciplinary team to try to all be detectives and try to ferret out all the different reasons that could be going on there. A good example is sometimes we work with kids who've never eaten before. So we don't know until they're starting to take food in their mouth, are they safe? We have potential of swallowing issues that can't be diagnosed until you're getting them to try some foods. You don't know until you try different textures, is their ability there to take those textures. And then also to the refusal part, the unwillingness to try the foods. There's so many kids that have not tried things. They say they don't like it or they can't do it. Once they start eating, Richard and I know this very well, they sometimes take off and they actually really enjoy the food. It's just they've never tried it. So we try to tackle the medical part of it by using the current medical technology and the knowledge we have. The oral motor piece, speech language and occupational therapists are experts in working on oral motor skills. It's almost like rehab for your mouth. This makes it easier for the child to chew something up or to manage the food, to avoid coughing and gagging. And then again, that behavioral piece is that exposing them gradually to these different foods, to if there's fear involved, to show them that you're okay, the food goes down and there's nothing that happens and you start to build up that momentum. And these things all work together. But we also take into account the family dynamic, because again, do the family have the resources to do the things that we're asking them to do? And also do the family have the resources to eat the foods that we're asking them to present to their child? So it really is a comprehensive approach to take care of things because of all the different variables involved.
Richard, maybe pick up on the approach that you take at Mount Washington, but also what happens if there is we don't succeed in addressing the feeding disorder adequately? What happens to that child?
So that's a really important question, because there is no quick solution to most of these issues. There are a few circumstances where, you know, relatively short-term psychology sessions will be able to help the child who has, you know, hurt themselves with swallowing and is avoiding food. You know, a short-term period with a psychologist seems to work. But most of these children do need a gradual approach to reintroduction or introduction of feeding. With the whole team, and trying, as Peter said, trying to understand if there's a medical oral motor issue or a behavioral issue or some of each of those things. We know that, you know, children can survive on tube feeds. It's really the hallmark of what we have done in pediatric GI in the last 30 years and making sure that children do get nutrition. But living with a tube is not the way to go for most people. And so we know that we really try to wean these children off of tube feeds to prevent them from becoming dependent on tube feeds. But we also know that if feeding disorders aren't treated early on, that can lead to permanent feeding disorders.
You know, the other part is that sometimes families get advice that this will remedy itself over time. Just keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, years can go by. We typically start to see kids when they start to enter going to school, because all of a sudden, boy, now I have this eating problem, you can't, the school can't handle it, or you're going social situations. And it could be very difficult to not work on those things. There are just thoughts of critical windows of time where these skills can be developed. But when you're talking about 10, 11, 12, and you haven't worked on this yet, it could be more difficult because the children are more ingrained in that process and what they're eating, and they don't know anything else there. So I think an assessment in an early period of time is very important, because you can really get it before it becomes a bigger thing.
Can each of you talk about where are the new treatments or research or discoveries that are on the horizon? Where is the field heading? Richard?
Well, you know, it's heading where it's been for a while, and that the establishment of interdisciplinary teams, and that needs to be broadened around the country. It's unfortunate that it's, you know, so difficult for some people to access those teams. So we really think that that's what our societies are trying to do, is to develop interdisciplinary teams to be able to help children significantly. I think as we begin to understand more about the GI issues and that it's more complex than just a little bit of reflux, I think, you know, that's where a lot of that is going to go, and better diagnostics in terms of, you know, is somebody hurting? Is their esophagus uncomfortable? Do they have too much acid production? I think we know that for a lot of children, but I think the technology for small babies has just not been as good as it could be. So I think that's one aspect of it. And I'm sure Peter has ideas about the behavioral approaches.
Yeah, one great thing that over the years is that there's now a lot of empirically supported research on the effective treatments for these kinds of feeding issues. So there's groups design and also single subject design with a variety of different therapeutic techniques.
Which is not sort of a legal document, like an IEP that requires ongoing assessments. And it's just a little bit sort of less of a legal contract in that sense. But these educational supports and accommodations are sort of a list of strategies that teachers can do in the classroom to support a child with ADHD, such as redirecting them to the task that's presented to them, giving them extended time, working in a quiet setting during activities that really require them to focus a little bit more. Whereas special education would really only be indicated if there was co-occurring sort of specific learning disorders that needed to be addressed with educational interventions at that child's level of sort of learning, or if their symptom severity interferes with their ability to be in the classroom setting, like if they could potentially be so sort of hyperactive that they can't stay in their seat and they need a one-to-one aid to sort of sit with them and keep them on task, that would be more of a special education support. And that's more common in younger children. I would say as children with ADHD advance through school, these the supports that we can offer through a 504 plan are usually sufficient, unless there's, again, these sort of comorbidities with learning disorders that need to be addressed.
Carrie, Stuart, we have 1 minute left. So let's in this last minute, each of you, what's the best advice you can give to parents whose child has been diagnosed with ADHD? Carrie, we'll start with you, and then Stuart.
Well, I think starting with that comprehensive evaluation to get an accurate diagnosis, to inform treatment planning and identify areas of strength, and then really building on those strengths for your child to help them build confidence and self-esteem and feel successful in the areas where they are intended to do so. So that would probably be the most important information I try to share with parents.
And Stuart?
Recognizing that it's a chronic lifelong condition often, so keeping that in mind, that it may require ongoing management support for a number of years. With that, recognizing that comprehensive treatment approaches are therefore really crucial. So not just simply focusing on medication, but also considering behavioral approaches such as mindfulness movement intervention that can really provide potentials for sustainable benefits and create a foundation for that can be lifelong for better regulating behavior, better controlling how we focus and stay on task.
Well, thank you, Stuart, Carrie. You guys are a wonderful resource of expertise. Thank you for taking us through. It's a brief discussion of ADHD. There's much more to talk about, but greatly appreciated. And you've been listening to Your Child's Brain. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR and producer Spencer Bryant. Please join us next time as we examine the mysteries of your child's brain.
And everybody has a concern about their children's health and well-being, but sometimes it's really far beyond what a normally acceptable difference is.
Really important point, Richard. I just want to underscore the how challenging it is for that general pediatrician, for the family practice doctor, for that frontline provider who is seeing a lot of patients in a brief period of time, that it's really important for parents to be explicit, as you say, to make clear the challenges that they're facing so that recognition of a potential feeding disorder is made promptly. You mentioned, Richard, that there's a couple of societies, one more practitioner-oriented, one more parent-oriented. Maybe let's just say them and we could potentially provide the information on the podcast website as well.
Yeah, the Parent and Family Society is Feeding Matters, based in Arizona. And the Professional Society doesn't have a very catchy name, but it's International Association of Pediatric Feeding and Swallowing. Both have websites, and there's a lot of information on both of them.
That's great. Peter, Richard, thank you so much for a rich conversation about the important issue of feeding disorders. Greatly appreciated. You've been listening to Your Child's Brain. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR and producer Spencer Bryant. Please join us next time as we examine the mysteries of your child's brain.